Welcome back. We're now going to hear from our second panel of the day. And it will be devoted to the topic of harmonizing privacy and innovation, U.S. and EU tensions and possibilities. As I mentioned, it's going to be then the perfect lead-in and introduction for our keynote speaker, Jan Albrecht. It's now my great pleasure to introduce Ken Bamberger, my dear colleague at UC Berkeley School of Law and fellow director of the Berkeley Center for Law and Technology. Ken's research focuses on the involvement of a variety of institutions, public and private, in governance. In particular, he writes on government decision-making, the role of corporate compliance in public administration, and questions of technology in governance, focusing there on the regulation of information privacy. He is a former clerk for U.S. Supreme Court Justice David H. Souter, and between his two clerkships, he was a Bristol Fellow in the Office of the U.S. Solicitor General. He came to Bolt in 2005 from Wilmer Cutler in D.C. Thank you very much, Ken, and I'll turn everything over to you.
Thank you, Paul. Can everyone hear me? Can anyone not hear me? I don't know if that question can be answered in the positive. I want to talk a little about this question of harmonizing privacy and innovation in the broader context of harmonizing between the United States and Europe. We're at an extraordinary time, literally an extraordinary week, a time of policy reform work on both sides of the Atlantic, where Congress and the White House on one hand and the European Parliament and other branches of European governments are focused so heavily on really thinking through how privacy governance and privacy regulation needs to be reformed and reconceived as our technological and societal platforms transform so quickly. So what I'd like to do is share some of the research that my colleague Deirdre Mulligan and I have been doing at the Berkeley Center for Law and Technology, research about what's really going on in the U.S. and Europe in corporations as a result of various regulatory choices, and then informed by that knowledge, think about what lessons we may have as we engage in this reform process going forward. Second, I want to talk a little about how all of this ties into the progression that the European Data Protection Regulation is making. And finally, I want to flag some tensions and possibilities that our superb panel can then step in and address from their own various vantage points. So our research recently published in a number of articles, including one called Privacy and Europe. Basically, we wanted to address the question, where do Europe and the U.S. converge, and where do they depart? Now, many of us are very familiar, too familiar, with the traditional framing of how U.S. and European regulation differ, a focus that really emphasizes the question of what's going on the books, what's the law on the books. And the distinctions that are frequently made between Europe and the United States are Europe embraces and has omnibus privacy regulation. In the U.S., it's fragmented. Europe has a dedicated privacy regulator. The U.S. does not. Europe embodies privacy in a language of fundamental rights. The United States does not. Europe is committed to a very robust vindication of informational self-determination. That notion is modified in the United States context. Enforcement and penalties, on the other hand, have long been, or at least the threat of them, have long been much more robust in the United States, the capacity of regulators to impose sizable penalties, and have not in Europe. This on-the-books discussion then usually ends with one or two hypotheses, that divergent legal choices, as these are framed, shape different outputs. They affect the comparative dedication of resources between Europe and the United States to privacy. They affect the attention given to privacy in Europe and the United States. And they promote or hinder good decision making. And in general, for the last decade and a half, the general understanding has been that all of these on-the-books elements, likely, we thought, created a much higher dedication of resources, attention, and good decision-making in Europe than they did in the United States. At least this was the claim among many. We saw some evidence on the ground that maybe the story was much more complicated. In the United States, we saw that clearly things had changed. Although the law didn't change, the formal law on the books didn't change, the situation on the ground did change. With the rise of privacy professionals, the IAPP, which now boasts 15,000 members, all kinds of associations thinking about privacy, consumer groups, nonprofit groups, an advocacy sector, all kinds of services arising in any law firm worth their salt, the development of privacy practices, and higher ed programs that really focused on privacy. So something was different from the traditional story in the United States, and I hope that the experience of everyone in this room is demonstration of that. As well, there was evidence of maybe not such a sunny picture on the European side. First, there was evidence of not necessarily activist, positive privacy decision-making, but more of a bureaucratization of privacy in Europe. A lot of paper filling out, a number of reports reported. And finally, the notion that there was a single Europe ended up not making a lot of sense. Anyone who's practiced privacy with firms working in Europe or in Europe itself knows that each jurisdiction in Europe offers a different privacy regulatory experience to those that they govern. So we decided to find out some more. And we've engaged in what we call the Privacy on the Ground Project, involving 125 targeted interviews with leading corporate privacy officers, as well as regulators, engineers, lawyers, and others in the privacy sphere. We've documented internal firm practices in five jurisdictions: the United States, France, Germany, Spain, and the UK. And we're now engaged in beginning broader surveys of firms to think about what happens not just at the small number of firms that we could interview and study, but rather down the line. So a couple of caveats about what we've done. We've not engaged in a measure of which jurisdictions' set of substantive privacy commitments are better. What we've engaged in is a question of which regulatory choices different jurisdictions have made, and how those decisions, those different choices, affect the ways corporations actually managerialize, operationalize, institutionalize privacy within the corporation. Second caveat is we looked at corporations that were identified as those involved with best practices, industry leaders. So this is a study of those who folks all across the privacy field have identified as industry leaders. It's not typical of firms across country, but it does, and it's meant to identify best practices. What did we find out? We found a set of best practices for privacy management that had arisen among industry leaders, not just in the United States, but also to some degree in Europe. Indeed, we saw a convergence of practices. The U.S. and Germany together actually shared a practice of privacy practices that was quite similar. The way privacy was dealt with in the corporations in the U.S. and Germany, very similar, while France and Spain diverged and the U.K. was kind of somewhere in between. So again, this notion of U.S. versus EU in terms of practice shattered. U.S. and Germany versus France versus Spain versus the U.K. So the question is, why? Why do we see this pattern emerging, and what can we learn for privacy reform? Looking at the emerging best practices, I'll just outline them for you. What we saw in the best firms were the existence of a chief privacy officer that was high up in the firm, that both held power and influence within the firm to discuss strategy, as well as had an external orientation, engaging with regulators, engaging with others in the privacy field, trying to get a sense of what was going on in privacy and bringing it back within the firm, what we call the translation function. The second element of best practices, the managerialization of privacy, that expertise was developed on privacy inside the firm, layers and layers of people trained and educated with regards to question of privacy. But it was not just in a single unit, and it was not just at one level, but in fact it was distributed throughout the firm through both tools that individuals were given to use, like privacy impact assessments, as well as technologies. And it leveraged, therefore, firm-wide risk management systems. Finally, there was this notion in these best practice firms of privacy as strategy and operations, not simply privacy as registration, privacy as providing notice. Now, these sets of best practices show a great deal of promise. They show a great deal of promise in light both of organizational behavior literature, which show that if you want to integrate privacy decision-making inside corporations without hampering innovation while promoting innovation in the protection of privacy, these ways of doing them, spreading them throughout the firm, actually show greatest promise. And we can see that in privacy research, where an emphasis on privacy by design, an emphasis on privacy impact assessments has taken hold. Let me move ahead. If we contrast this, the second piece we found was that there was a certain set of understandings of privacy that informed and shaped and triggered these corporate best practices. In the U.S., privacy was not about compliance. It was about things like managing risk, promoting trust, preserving consumer expectations, and avoiding those types of affirmative harms. The German leaders' definitions were different. They talked about compliance, but they didn't only talk about compliance. They talked about a compliance plus, nested in broader ethical frames, where data protection was linked to privacy, to social interests, to ethical obligations, to workers' rights, not just to specific elements, formal elements of the law that was on the books. If you contrast that with Spain, in Spain the privacy leaders talked about privacy as a political thing, unpredictable, volatile. They said compliance was not realistic. And on the ground, how did they deal with this? They instituted privacy as a legal task. It was about following rules. It was about isolated privacy workers. It was about focusing inwards and not looking outwards. And in France, the leaders described privacy as all about compliance, all about a detailed rules-based approach. And in France, unlike the United States and Germany, chief privacy officers were not elevated officers within the firm, but rather the privacy function was allocated to mid-level lawyers working in a siloed, compliance-focused privacy function. In fact, when we began our interviews, two-thirds of the firms that we looked at, that we studied, two-thirds of the firms that the French policy field had identified as the best firms on privacy in France didn't even have a dedicated chief privacy officer or privacy lead in that respect. It was allocated to other folks who had multiple duties and for whom privacy was not their primary function. Okay, so what legal choices made by the different jurisdictions do we think shaped both the companies that engaged in best practices and the companies that did not. There were four. First was a distinction between countries that embraced substantive requirements around privacy and those that emphasized procedure. What do I mean by that? Substantive, meaning protection of consumer values, protection against harms, protection of ethical values, institutionalization through decision-making, rather than protection of processes, the offering of processes for individuals to vindicate choice, not in a substantive way, but through notice and, I'm sorry, that should say consent, filing registrations about cross-border transfers. So it's not that some jurisdictions didn't do some of both of these things, but where they emphasized one over the other, the jurisdictions that emphasized substance rather than procedure ended up with these robust practices, while the others did not. The second element is whether regulation and the regulators' actions embodied a flexibility, a dynamism that changed along with technological change and change in threat models, or whether legal rules were articulated with a great deal of specificity, formal, specific rules. In the former, you ended up with corporations embracing these best practices. Where rules were very specific, you ended up with a formalized, limited, compliance-focused function. The third element was transparency versus bureaucracy, where privacy was a publicly discussed element, promoting public pressure on corporations, pressure on corporations. You were more likely to see best practices, where privacy was made formally transparent by the filling out and filing of forms. You saw less of this. And finally, the question of whether the regulator or the law involved other players in a negotiation about privacy, that too turned out to be an important element. How did this all come together? In the U.S. and Germany, you ended up with a system of a regulator. In the U.S., it's the Federal Trade Commission. In Germany, it's the various lender, who were much more flexible, much more dynamic, much more uncertain about the regulations that they were threatening to enforce. You ended up with an FTC that embraced what scholars call a new governance form, a new governance approach, where under the unfair and deceptive practices, they ended up involving discussions that invited in private actors, invited in privacy advocates, and ended up having very public and very engaged discussions about what privacy was about. In Germany, you saw a similar mesh of things coming from a different way. Corporations there, too, ended up in these kind of negotiations with regulators through a lot of ex-ante involvement with regulators. You saw, again, negotiation around the question of privacy by the involvement of workers' councils in German corporations. And you saw a fourth negotiator around the meaning of privacy in the form of the data protection officer who was required by German law to be employed by each firm, and which position holds a great deal of independence and also access to the board of directors, something that you see, although it's not required by law, in the United States as well. Contrast with France and Spain. In France, the understanding of privacy, our respondents were clear, comes not from discussions or negotiations with the firm, but rather from the CNIL itself. In the end, it's the CNIL that decides. There is limited, if no, third-party involvement in these discussions in France, although I note that there is, we saw towards the end of our interviews, some ongoing transformation of the practices that corporations are doing in France. And in Spain, you saw as well not a a broad, flexible, dynamic negotiation about privacy, but rather a focus on what our respondents thought were unachievable formalities. They said there's no way we can comply, we just pay the fine, and a view that, in a sense, it was all politics. The reason why we went through this exercise, and it's taken us almost 3 years to do this work, is to try to come up with these factors that have worked the best in the living laboratory in these five jurisdictions, where we have four of the jurisdictions acting under the same formal directive, implemented in different ways. So what are the choices about implementation that promotes robust privacy decision-making in corporations, and what doesn't? And I hope I've given you some summary there. We're at an extraordinary moment, and we have an extraordinary guest for that extraordinary moment. Just 2 days ago, the European Parliament voted on the new regulation and the enforcement directive, or more formally, the rapporteur's reports, and we're lucky to have one of the rapporteurs here. They didn't just approve them, but they approved them of a vote of 621-10. With 22 abstaining. Quite an extraordinary turn of events. And you can see here the European Commission press release quoting Minister Reding, progress on EU data protection reform now irreversible. So we're moving down a road. Now, the regulation in its current form, because of the bicameral system, doesn't go into effect until parallel versions are approved by both the Parliament and the Council of Ministers. The Council of Ministers meets in June, but pushed a number of ways last week in the same direction as the Parliament. So we'll see what happens in their form of the regulation, and we'll see how any differences are negotiated. But what I thought I might do is think about some of the elements of the regulation in light of our findings. Now, there are some answering the question, how might the regulation do on the metrics of our research? There are some key knowns that I'm not sure necessarily speak either way to that question. The regulation will put in place a single law for all countries, all member countries in the EU. Its jurisdictional breadth will extend not just to European countries, but also to, companies, but to any company, even United States companies doing business in Europe. It will provide administrative efficiency through a one-stop shop where you choose a single national regulator and your regulation is administered through that regulator. It requires prior authorization for cross-border data release, a kind of registration element. And in general, I took this quote from someone the other day who said, it's a profoundly powerful statement in favor of people's ability to control, I think ability got blocked by the EU map, people's ability to control their own data. So I'm not sure that an emphasis entirely on self-control of data or on registration for cross-border data release necessarily points us in the direction of robust privacy decision-making. In fact, one of the things that our respondents told us a lot was that an emphasis on you as a firm, when you're building a product or developing a service, you need to make sure that informational self-determination is vindicated. They say that's not so useful in a world where our refrigerators are constantly sending back and forth information. To do that, it's not that helpful for us in terms of knowing how to treat that information. That, in fact, more helpful is a kind of substantive metric of what to do. So I don't know what to say about those key elements, but I do get encouragement on the metrics we've put forward about a number of things. First is the required appointment of a data protection officer in every firm of more than 250 employees, the ability to impose penalties up to $100 million or 5% of global annual turnover, no small potatoes, the adoption of our own California Innovation, the data breach notification requirements, Vice President Justice Minister Redding's emphasis on privacy by design, and specific elements of that in terms of requiring risk assessments of most processing operations. So there is possible encouragement there, but there are huge unknowns, even if the regulation is to pass as currently framed. We don't really know how any of this is going to be implemented. Are the rules that are implementing them going to be specific, or are they going to provide some ambiguity so that the prevailing regulators can have flexibility as technology changes? The flexibility that we've seen promotes innovation in dealing with privacy within corporations. Are regulators going to be able to take advantage of new governance tools to create privacy negotiation? Are regulators under this new system going to be able to or choose to engage in ex-ante advising of corporations to make sure that corporations can reach these goals before having the threat of these penalties? And what enforcement tools will be allowed, for example, to individual national regulators? What kind of flexibility will they have? Finally, what will happen to some of the nascent advocacy sector development initiatives, such as the law in Germany, which came into effect on Monday, which permits civil society groups to sue firms in the case of a data breach, for the first time working to create, as the FTC did in the United States in its own way, a civil society activist element around privacy. So we just don't know. I want to flag, though, some tensions and possibilities, and then I'll turn it over to our panel to discuss. One major tension, of course, is the jurisdictional reach of the new regulation. Under its terms, U.S. companies doing business in Europe will be covered. They will have to act according to the same regulatory standards. So that obviously creates a new set of requirements for American companies. Second, at the same time that the regulation and the directive were enacted, the Parliament also voted on a report and a non-binding resolution by the Committee on Civil Liberties, Justice, and Home Affairs that involved two elements of real interest to American corporations and American lawyers. The first is the suggestion that the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership will be endangered if the United States does not shape up, in particular, in terms of government surveillance. And this actually is an old issue for Europeans. A significant number of the firms that we interviewed, even before Edward Snowden's papers were released, mentioned that they choose to keep their cloud data in Europe. Why? Because they were afraid of the Patriot Act. Obviously, it may not be the Patriot Act specifically that they're afraid of, but they were afraid of exactly what Snowden ended up revealing. And the second outcome of this report and resolution regarding American surveillance is the recommendation that data transfers under the U.S.-EU Safe Harbor Framework and other such agreements be immediately suspended. Obviously, this shakes the foundations of EU-US data transfer practice up until now. The last piece, I guess, is the one that I kind of mentioned already, is at least the anecdotal piece that not just from Europeans but also talking to U.S. cloud companies, that they're sensing an effect of European companies withdrawing or choosing not to place their data in the U.S. cloud and instead keeping it on European soil, whatever that means in the cloud. At the same time, we've seen some what I might call possibilities. Just last week, APEC and the G29, Article 29 Working Group, embraced what they called referential, a new cross-border transfer tool that might allow APEC and G29 member companies to transfer data cross-border above and beyond the Safe Harbor Agreement. And there was at that time, when this was announced, where Chairwoman the chairman of the FTC, as well as the head of the G29, expressed a very profound dedication to working towards interoperability. That same day, the leaders of the G29 went and met with members of Congress and spoke with them about the potential upcoming tensions and their desire to avoid them. I had the opportunity to meet with some of those same members later in the day, and let me tell you, they really heard what the Europeans said. And their only question was, what can we do? What might we do to get closer to the European sense of appropriate behavior? With that kind of bringing us just about as up to date as I can, I want to introduce our terrific panel and turn it over to them. First is Andrew Serwin, partner in the Global Privacy and Data Security Practice Group at Morrison & Foerster. And he also serves as CEO and Executive Director of the Lars Institute, which is a think tank focused on information management issues, and is a member of the advisory team of the Naval Postgraduate School's Center for Asymmetric Warfare. So be careful if you want to disagree with him. He advises a number of Fortune 500 and emerging companies regarding global privacy compliance and technology transactions, and works on issues like international compliance, ECPA, wiretap issues, healthcare, mobile communications, and the breadth of information security issues. He's represented these clients in front of the FTC, where he's had a number of high-profile matters, before the Office of Civil Rights, and in class actions and enforcement matters. Next to him is Kurt Wimmer, the U.S. Chair of Covington and Burling's Privacy and Data Security Practice, and a partner concentrating on privacy and technology law. He advises national and multinational companies on privacy and data security, content, and digital technology issues. And he's chair of the Privacy and Information Security Committee of the ABA's Antitrust Section, and co-chair of the privacy. He's co-chair of something really great. And I'm going to have to come back.
Let's leave it with that.
Yeah, okay, I'm going to have to come back and tell you what that is. But he's done, importantly for this panel, done significant work on privacy, both through postings in Europe and also through his leadership of this major domestic practice at Covington. Finally, I'd like to welcome Chris Sundermeyer, General Counsel and Chief Privacy Officer for Reputation.com. He was previously a litigation partner for more than a decade right here in the Silicon Valley office of Cooley, where he focused on disputes involving complex commercial contracts and technology agreements, securities fiduciary duty, and M&A-related matters. Chris tells us that he spends as much time as he can at his farm in Sonoma pursuing his right to be forgotten on weekends. I'm going to sit down and I'm going to ask Andy, maybe you can share a few comments from your perspective with us.
Sure, and what we are going to do is, I think, certainly from my perspective, react to some of the research that, frankly, all of us just heard. So my perspective on it, I'll come at it more from the information governance and think tank side, is how do we harmonize if we can? What are the challenges to that? And more importantly, perhaps why? I think to take a step back and summarize a lot of work I've done at the think tank, innovation has always been a challenge for privacy. There's this wonderful law review article about the collision of technology and privacy that was written in the 1920s by Warren and Brandeis over the instant camera, which was felt to be a massive privacy invasion at the time. And so I think as long as we have technological advance, we are going to have the collision of policy, law, and privacy. And so I think it's I would hope we could solve some of these things over time, but the reality is these have been issues for about 100 years, if not more, and I don't think we can solve them quickly through even through law. Let me draw a distinction between information governance, because we talked a little bit about that, and privacy, because as companies use information more, we're really at this place where I think security is different and looks at a different data set than privacy in some cases, and how companies monetize data is a little different. I'll define privacy as a societal norm that's sometimes expressed in law that really regulates the collection, protection, processing, and deletion of data regarding an individual, and really regarding an only an individual. So we're not worried about your company's proprietary data here. We're really worried about what someone has that is about an individual. And I think part of the reason I see these distinctions, my research is focused on the U.S. and the U.S. market. Privacy, if you accept that it's a societal norm, is really a cultural issue many times. It's certainly expressed in law ultimately, but it starts as a societal norm that has a cultural base. And when I have researched this over now about 4 or 5 years, there are even distinctions within the United States over who thinks what about privacy. And so it isn't as simple as saying, as we sometimes do, that the younger you are, the less you care. It's a little more complicated than that. And so what we see is the baby boomers in particular are very concerned about privacy in different ways than people who are both older and younger. And so I think part of what you see with the research we've seen here is to look at Europe broadly is as naive as looking at the United States broadly or even an individual country in Europe broadly, because there will be cultural differences even within each country, and there will be country-specific differences based on societal differences. I think Germany has had a different experience with data than the United States, and that is reflected in the societal norms we see about data use there. So I think, I will say my data is U.S. specific, but seeing the conclusions and the slides we see there, I think it is reflective of the fact that to have a single view of privacy and impose a single view on privacy across cultures or across age groups is at best a bit naive. And I think we have to get to a place where if we're going to design privacy, designing privacy really means not just thinking about it when you design a product, but actually looking at what is, I think, the most relevant for privacy, which is what do the individuals in question think. Security is a little different. Security, I think many people in this room know and understand the security issues better than your average consumer. And it's not to say that regulators and professionals don't have a role, but one of the key metrics that I think gets glossed over at times is what do the individuals actually think about their own data? And how should that be factored in when we have a data use if it's extremely sensitive data? Because I think that is the ultimate conclusion of this, is not all data is equal and not all people are equal. So if you have to look at who your data population is, you have to look at the data set you're using, and then you have to look at what use is being made of that data. And that can help you design privacy in a way that is a little less monolithic. And I think that's where, as we move forward, if we want to try to harmonize, part of it may be recognizing that there are inherent tensions and difficulties in actually coming up with a privacy model that works across a country the size of the United States or across Europe. I don't think it's, frankly, that feasible.
First I have to start off with the standard disclaimer that I'm not speaking for any of my clients or my firm, maybe not even for myself. And my Brussels partners wanted me to specifically disclaim that to Mr. Albrecht that I'm absolutely not speaking for them. It's interesting that both Ken and Andy talked about privacy being a cultural norm and things being different in different countries. I was reminded of a time I was sitting on a commission to draft a new information law for Bosnia after the former Yugoslavia broke up. And there were, of course, 2 Serbs, 2 Croats, and 2 Bosniaks, and Europeans and U.S. people. And the question of whether people should have access to the state police records came up. And, you know, the standard American view would be, of course, absolutely, people should have access. And I think the Europeans on the commission believed that also, but the locals said, no, that would inflame tensions because all that information was just made up. And then people would start getting angry at each other again, and then we'd have more war. So it's an eye-opening experience. Ken asked us to talk a little bit about whether privacy can coexist with innovation, and I tend to think that it really can. I work with a lot of privacy-sensitive companies that are also incredibly innovative, both in the U.S. and European markets. It does take a lot of work, and there are sort of baseline principles of European and U.S. privacy that can be interoperable and that you can look at and say, this is what we really have to focus on, regardless of where we're practicing. The concern that I have, and the prism through which – I'm sorry, I said prism – The way to look at this is
the lens
through which we should look at this, though, is not, you know, what can mature companies do when they have a significant privacy staff, or what can larger firms do when they have resources. But what does an entrepreneur do? What happens with a very early stage company that may not have legal resources inside, that may not have the ability to have a chief privacy officer in the very early going? And I think that adds a layer of difficulty to the question, because there is a real value in knowing, you know, what law is going to apply to you and what the content of that law is going to be. And that, I think, is where privacy can really be a dilemma for emerging companies. I do tend to think that we're not quite as far apart as others do. I did spend some time practicing in Europe. I sort of sometimes envy my partners who have, you know, a very consistent and specific set of regulations that can be the basis of advice, when over here it's a little bit more nebulous than that. But I do think it's important for companies to be able to know, you know, what law will apply to them. And that's one reason why I do have some concerns about the jurisdictional approach of the EU regulation, because I think there are a whole class of companies, particularly in the U.S., that think of themselves as U.S. companies with occasional traffic from Europe or Asia. But to apply the whole panoply of European law to a company that really doesn't have facilities, people, or an effort really to serve that market really raises the complexity level for smaller companies to a degree that I think will be very difficult for them. So I do have, you know, some concerns about that element of the European regulation. I do think there are more things in common though than are different from our various policies. I mean, we don't have a broad overarching privacy law, clearly, but on the areas that people really care the most about, their finances, their health, their kids, we do have a pretty highly developed set of laws and regulations. We clearly have a long way to go, and it may be a while before we are able to get Congress to move on something. And so the FTC has stepped into the breach, and as Ken described, has really built out of a 1919 law that talks about unfair and deceptive trade practices, an entire jurisprudence of privacy. It's a little bit difficult, however, I think, to advise companies on the FTC's views because there are no cases. When we talk about a jurisprudence of FTC decisions, and Dan Sala has written a really interesting new law review article on the federal common law of privacy as determined by the FTC's views, we're really looking at a bunch of settlements. And it's very difficult to advise clients on what the law should be based on what a company agreed to settle with the government for, because often those decisions are driven by the need to avoid a 20-year consent decree, the need to avoid some significant reputational damage, the need to avoid litigation with an extremely powerful opponent. So I think there is a lack of clarity on our side that also can be an impediment to companies really understanding what their obligation should be. I do agree, though, that with Ken, that what the FTC has done in the past few years has been extremely productive, which is to empanel groups of experts to act as a moderator of different viewpoints and to publish guidelines of best practices, which clearly aren't binding, but do provide a fair amount of information for all companies about what the expectations are. And it does seem to me that those start to form the general shared views that we all have about privacy, some of which are pretty close, I think, to the European views.
Thanks. So I wanted to come here today to bring a slightly different perspective. We have people here who've been experts in the legal and scholarly study of privacy for many, many years. I've been doing this only for a couple of years. So I was a litigation partner at the Cooley Law Firm for years, did some privacy litigation, occasionally got involved in matters that involved privacy regulation, some COPPA stuff, then took a job as the general counsel and chief privacy officer at a small company, and had to on the fly, learn very quickly the rules around privacy for a company. And part of my job, because we are a privacy company, we are a company that sells privacy products, is to be a spokesperson on the issues of privacy. So it's been a real education over the last couple of years. But one of the things I do think is happening is, I mean, the topic of this discussion was initially privacy and innovation, and it's really morphed into, like, privacy and innovation, how that's going to be impacted by the EU changes, and all of which I think have been tension has been greatly escalated as of this week. I was in privacy conferences over the last couple of months where there was a lot of skepticism about whether these rules would pass. They now have. I think that's going to be alarming to a lot of people. The perspective I want to bring is to someone who is trying to figure this out as a company, trying to do the right thing. I mean, we are a privacy company, so we are definitely focused on doing the right thing, creating solutions for privacy for our customers, as well as being a responsible citizen ourselves. And we're a company that is small and has offices in Europe. And the EU laws, I think, have a very, very significant effect on our view about how we expand into Europe. The fact that you're a small company, that you have to deal with potentially very onerous rules about privacy, make us think twice and three times about what we're going to do with respect to Europe. Even maintaining a single office in Europe is a difficult proposition for a small company, particularly one that's trying to focus on growth as opposed to building infrastructure and systems to maintain separations of data, et cetera. So it's been something that I think the EU tension, I think, is stifling to innovation. In general, though, I do not think that privacy is stifling to innovation. I think what's going on right now vis-a-vis Europe is a lot of uncertainty about how to grow, what the potential downside is. I think we've at least had a number of years prior to the new passing of this legislation where people felt like they had some handle on how privacy matters are going to be dealt with in Europe. I think right now people are very up in the air, and particularly small companies, and that is going to chill the expansion of smaller companies into Europe. On the issue of privacy and innovation generally, though, I do believe that privacy, in some ways I view the concerns about privacy as the concerns about the environment. It's like being green, okay? To be green, you really have to focus a lot of your attention on your day-to-day life. There are easy choices all the time in front of you that are not environmentally sound. There are easy choices all the time in front of you that are less expensive that are not environmentally sound. The privacy world, there are choices being presented to us all the time where you'll give up your privacy. They are not privacy sound, where you will, if you want to actually have privacy in some ways in this world, you have to focus on it all the time. You have to oftentimes have to pay more for it. The environmentally sound products are frequently more expensive. But there is a whole culture around innovating in the environmental space. And I think the exact same thing is happening in the privacy space. I think there is just a burst of innovation around security, around new technologies for maintaining privacy, around, you know, telephones, the new black phone, the various secure phones that are coming out, around email that is secure, that is encrypted, around, you know, technologies where you can maintain your privacy while searching on the internet. I think there is an explosion of technology that is trying to tackle the problem that is in front of us right now. So rather than privacy being a stifler of innovation right now, I actually think what we as a culture are good at is looking at a problem and trying to figure the best way around it. And what privacy is doing right now as it's grown in the last few years, because 5 years ago, you know, if you met someone that was an expert in privacy, they were a very rare person. Now there are thousands of privacy experts. If you go to the IAAP conference in D.C., there are thousands of people there, thousands of vendors, hundreds of companies there trying to sell products in privacy. So I think that actually the issue of privacy and the urgency with which it is beginning to be felt is actually really promoting innovation in an interesting way.
Yeah, and let me actually pick up on the innovation point, because I think obviously complying with the law, whether it's the U.S., EU, that I think is the minimum for the legal compliance side. But if we accept, again, this cultural definition of privacy, what we're really saying is certainly in the U.S., based on the research I've done, privacy is a brand and trust issue. And if you accept that, then doing what the law requires may just be the beginning. And I think where, when I have researched this, I can put people generally into three categories of low, medium, and high sensitivity about privacy. And the reason they care and what they'll look at and how much information they'll give you will vary depending on how trust, how sensitive they are, really. And frankly, the reason that business has to care about this beyond legal is, across the board, 40% of the buying population, based on my research, is making buying decisions based on privacy. And when you look at the high sensitivity group, it's 54%. In the U.S., that skews to baby boomers with high income and high education levels. And so the, you know, the message I would give to companies, putting the law aside, is if you want to alienate one of your best markets with a lot of discretionary income, don't care about privacy. And so I think that's one of the things, as we innovate, we've got to look beyond what the FTC has said or other things and look at really what the consumer's expectations are, whether that is embodied in law or not.
Maybe I'll ask a question, and then if you guys can start thinking about your own questions, it would be exciting to involve you as well. On one side, I heard Kurt both amazed at the development of this FTC jurisprudence and what it's accomplished, and on the other hand, a little bit dismayed in the notion that as legal counselors, we're supposed to provide clear answers for our clients. It's very hard to know what those clear answers are, and the point was raised as well about what, especially in the context of small and medium enterprises, you can't have a completely robust privacy system that's larger than your company. On the other hand, there is, I've heard from all of you at some point, this notion that the more rule-like the requirements are, then they end up becoming burdensome and they potentially stifle innovation. So I guess the question is, if both of these directions squish companies and squish innovation in some forms, how do we resolve that?
It's a great question. I think that my own view, in a perfect world, you'd have relatively straightforward laws, so you knew what the law was, you knew how to conform your behavior to the laws, but it has to be enforced with a great deal of flexibility, especially in technological spaces where things are changing or are changing quickly. That is one advantage of the FTC's approach in that there really is very little law that they're applying, so they can change direction pretty adeptly if they decide to do so.
My own view is that right now the complexity with which the world is changing and technology is changing, that it can be very, very difficult at any time soon to have any clear set of rules around privacy, and that we're going to be needing to rely on industry, on professionals that are involved in privacy, in the notion that companies build brand value, build their own reputations based on their appreciation of their consumers' need for privacy, and that we will get a set of slowly evolving rules, like California is leading the way in doing, but those are going to stay unclear for a while, and that we will need to struggle through that. But I think in a way, that is going to actually enhance our ability to figure out the right path. I think if we went to a rule-bound system at this point, we would stifle innovation, and it would create a lot of problems around how businesses and companies, as the technology and as the economy evolves, comply with those rules. So I think we're on the right path, actually.
Yeah, and I think you see that at the data security level at the states. I mean, you have about 30 states that have basically said, to the extent they provide for data destruction or data security, be reasonable. And two states, really Massachusetts and Nevada, that have said, here are the standards you must meet. And I think there's not alignment even at the state level now on how to handle that flexibility.
Do folks in the audience have questions or want to jump in?
Yeah, my name is Ben Lanai, and I help run a medical research foundation. So we're trying to build a web platform to allow for private networking among patients and with clinicians, and to enroll into clinical trials. And we have a big cluster in the U.S. and a big cluster in Germany, France, and Spain. So all your troubled countries. So what are some of the gotchas we should look at when we ask users to turn over a lot of very private health information, and then we proactively approach them about enrolling into medical research opportunities, including trials?
What was the beginning of that last question?
Well, so as we're trying to have an international reach, you know, both essentially have the same platform in the U.S. and is in those three European countries and eventually Europe-wide, how should we go about deploying our website, you know, both in terms of data and functionality in the U.S. versus Europe?
From the U.S. perspective, obviously we have the wonderful world of HIPAA, which I would say of the U.S. laws is probably, with the way it defines identifiable information, the most sort of EU, it's most similar to the EU view of what's identifiable. So I think you've got, you know, that is an area where I think you'd probably see a bit more alignment around the U.S. approach and the European approach. It won't be the same, but because we do have a sector-specific law, assuming you are covered by HIPAA, in this context, I think you're going to see a little less disconnect between the two sets of laws.
Yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, you're dealing with some of the most sensitive information you can imagine. So I'm guessing you're probably getting a lot of opt-in consents by your subjects as you gather the information, which will help you both in the U.S. and the EU. So I think, oddly enough, this is one where it's a very difficult area, but it is probably simpler. Yeah. In terms of the privacy side, just because of the sensitivity of what you're dealing with.
Hi, I'm Anjali. I just wanted to ask a little bit more about the issues that the smaller startup companies are going to be having with the new directives from the European Union. What are the next steps that you foresee those smaller corporations having to take to comply with the data privacy regulations?
Well, from my perspective, I think it'll depend a little bit on what the regulation actually looks like as it passes. I think a lot of companies that didn't find themselves under European jurisdiction probably will after the regulation passes, and so they'll have to decide, you know, is it going to be enough for me to say in my privacy policy I'm a company established under the laws of the United States, and those laws apply when you come to visit my site. That may or may not work in the new environment. And so for some companies that you know, deal a lot with EU citizens, even though it's a tiny percentage of what they do, they might find themselves having to look at, you know, complying with European laws for the first time.
Yeah, as a small company in that situation, we are subject to UK laws because we have an office in the UK, but we also are taking advantage of the safe harbor right now. And we are conscientious about the transmission of information, and we try to comply with all the rules. But once that safe harbor is gone, frankly, we have to, I mean, and I think the discussion in the last few months is, will that happen? And there's a lot of consternation about whether or not that will happen. I think the likelihood that will happen just increased dramatically this week. And so we really are going to be in a regrouping mode where we stop and have to figure out how are we going to address these if we are you know, no longer able to take advantage of the safe harbor. I think, again, we're not a company that has a chief privacy officer in Europe. We, you know, we have a small office in Europe. I think there are probably a lot of people who are in this position where the information flows regularly back and forth between the Europe and the U.S. And we are going to have to sit down, probably get advice from people who are real experts in this issue, and try to, you know, put in place the systems that will be necessary, which is costly. It's a big focus of resources. And it's, you know, who knows exactly how that will impact business. But I can tell you, as we're thinking about opening other offices in Europe, it's definitely a question on our mind as to, you know, an added burden and cost and expense of doing so.
You know, it's almost harder for a small company because you don't have the option of saying, okay, European data can stay in Europe, because you're a small company, you've got to have data flowing back and forth all the time.
Exactly.
I think this is also one of those questions where implementation will matter a lot, because by its terms, the regulation and enforcement directives are both very explicitly sensitive to the question of SMEs, not just in avoiding specific requirements like no required DPO for companies with fewer than 250 employees, but a suggestion that as the rules are written across the board, that's going to have to be taken into account. So the question is, as the implementation of allowances for small and medium-sized companies interact with questions of territoriality and extra-European territoriality, how are those going to, in practice, combine?
This is usually the time when someone reminds us of how the U.S. likes to apply its laws extraterritorially, too. But
true, and I mean, I also, if I'm not mistaken, our colleague Professor Schwartz has also written at times about the powers that European authorities have, to particularly German authorities have, to surveil data as well. So I do note that it's not as if some of the concerns about the United States don't exist under European law. So the question is everybody kind of doing the same thing but now currently upset about it? And can we find common ground?
Hello, my name is Nicole, and I have a question kind of building on what Christopher was saying about innovation, about privacy spurring innovation. And one thing that came to mind was the recent app Zello that's been used in the Ukraine and Venezuela by protesters that basically is taking off because it's providing privacy and anonymity to protesters that otherwise couldn't organize with anonymity. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts about how these innovations might instigate or spur regulatory changes in those developing countries, or if at all, or if there's any effect jurisdictionally on this issue about whose laws are going to be enforcing those apps and in the pursuit of allowing that privacy. Does that make sense?
Makes sense. I'm not familiar with the app. So,
yeah. it's a social networking app that is basically kind of like a walkie-talkie app, but it gives anonymity, so there's no way of knowing who's communicating, so the government can't find out where somebody is. I guess they're scrambling the IP address from time to time to kind of hide that. So unlike Twitter, where you can identify who the people are organizing and then squash those protests, these apps are allowing the organizers to do that without being identified.
Yeah.
So,
it does point to the how quickly people innovate, particularly around these kind of particular problems. And I think it is amazing how when a serious problem presents itself, minds go immediately to how to fix this. It's ironic that here in the U.S. we have products like, I think it's called Whisper, and there's a couple others that it's more they're meant to be private sort of social networks, but what we use them for is gossip and sharing all kinds of horrible information, as opposed to what is a really legitimate purpose, which is protecting civil rights and people's ability to protest.
Well, I think the point really is, we've been in a realm where up until now, I think at least innovation has been seen as invasive of privacy, but I don't think that's, given the concerns we're seeing in the post-Snowden world, I think the reality is innovation is not inherently invasive or protective of privacy. It's what people really decide to do. And so I think the answer is, if there's a market for it that can be served by business, I think you will see a lot of privacy innovation. And I think as we, when I look at these issues, you tend to see certain groups that have had a cultural experience like Watergate, let's say, or the Church Commission, which started our fund with the FISA court, not the Patriot Act. Those groups tend to be very concerned about privacy. So I think if you see a cultural shift in the U.S. or where people are concerned about it, or as you point out in the Ukraine, you're going to see companies step in and try to innovate to serve that need.
think we have time for one more question. There's a hand here.
Thanks. Charles Cresson Wood. I'm concerned about documenting due diligence. And in the information security field, we increasingly are looking towards automated real-time documentation that the controls are working properly. And encrypting logs to be able to validate after the fact, indeed, the controls were working properly. And we can show that in court. And, you know, we've got chain of custody and everything else we need in order to demonstrate due diligence from the standpoint of management. But if we look at the arena of harmonization, I'd like to make the analogy to plumbing. And the way things have really worked quite well, if we harmonize on, for instance, pipe width, and then we can get different manufacturers' pipes to fit together, and the plumbers are able to create all sorts of new connections, perhaps a local water system. I think the internet can be analogized to a plumbing system. In order to facilitate business, to facilitate harmonization, cross-cultural agreements about privacy and things like that, what are the parameters that we should look at when it comes to making things more transparent, when it comes to recording that we have done a good job in the arena of privacy?
I'll start. I think the analogy is probably closer to the security side. I think security tends to be a bit more, for lack of a better term, binary. I think that's an easier thing to do. Privacy, you certainly can have metrics around disclosures regarding your practices, but I think because of, you know, from my view at least, because you do have these cultural differences, it's not quite as easy as saying sort of one size fits all. I think the process may be the same, but I think it looks very different in the implementation.
And I...
please.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say I agree with that. I think it's it becomes very difficult when normative issues interface with the engineering issues. I mean, W3C is great at setting standards, and IETF is great at setting standards. But then when you sort of have to figure out what do not track means, for example, and have meetings over the course of months and can't come up with it, it is very difficult on the privacy side. Maybe better on the security
side.
Well,
the last few presentations I've been a part of, it starts out with a question to the panel. What is privacy? So we not only don't have agreement on the width of the pipe, we don't even have an agreement on what privacy is. And I think cross-culturally, that gets even more difficult. So I think we're a long way from that model or making much progress that way.
And I actually think that's a lovely question to end on, because in a sense it also brings in the question of how do we make things more reliable and easier for firms to comply, and especially for small and medium-sized firms. Wouldn't it be great if we had, you know, what people may originally have thought of as privacy by design, where you just, you know, you have the program that kind of sets it all out. You have the IEEE standard, and you plug it in, and then out the other side comes privacy. And in fact, the more you can create systems, especially technological systems, to guide impact assessments and other things within firms, the cheaper, it becomes potentially cheaper for smaller firms to do privacy. But ultimately, you have to make sure that it's not the values that happen to be written into whatever technological choices are made that ultimately make the substantive decisions at the end of the day, but rather that the human beings come in at the right time, and really those technologies and those standards are in service of promoting human judgment about legal compliance, about questions like culture, and about privacy. So thanks very much. We'll see you back here 1 o'clock for an amazing talk.